Empire podcast this week, we rubbed the rabbit's foot, and what do you know? Simon Pegg and Rebecca Ferguson stripped off their masks and appeared out of nowhere to talk Mission : Impossible - Dead Reckoning, Part 1. All that and more on the movie podcast that would join the umptpa in starving writers and now actors into submission, except that even giggling idiots like us realise that that's a terrible strategy to announce to the world. Hello, Pod. I'm Helen, and I am covering today for my colleague Chris Hewitt, who can't be here due to not wanting to be. He, for some reason, wanted to be with visiting family and friends. So,
how dare he?
Bit rude.
Absolutely, how dare he?
I heard he was on strike. His SAG-AFTRA credentials came through, and he is now, even now as we speak, being a twat on a picket line.
That would make sense, given his massive role in Hostel 2.
That's true, yeah.
Anyway, fear not, because I'm obviously, as you've heard, joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning. With me today is a man who knows more about Disney than even Walt's severed head could dream of. It's Ben Travis. How are you doing?
I'm great. I've recovered Walt's severed head from the catacombs of Disney World, which is why I have all of his knowledge as well as my own built machine for that. So, yeah, I'm doing great.
Great engineering. Well done. And, of course, we are also joined by James Dyer, the man who can probably recite the name of every person beheaded in Game of Thrones book or TV show.
I'll tell you this. The next person to be beheaded, unfortunately, is in this very room.
What?
Ben and I have bad blood.
Oh, yes. No.
Don't we, Ben? You are not the man.
I survived the Great War.
Oh, no. You got Tay tickets and he didn't?
Uh-huh. I have Taylor Swift tickets.
He does.
I have my Eras Tour ticket.
I cannot tolerate it.
I see what you did there.
You see what I'm continuing to do?
This is a cruel summer for you, James.
Yeah, I think don't blame me is what you need to say. Yeah, but I'm going to, Ben. I'm going to blame you because you had a pre-sale code.
I knew
Shake it
you
off.
Were trouble
Shake it
when
off.
You walked in.
Yeah, that's it. That's it. You are not the one and all of these things.
I was going to say, I don't know about you, but I'm feeling 22, but I haven't felt 22 for about 10 years.
You are not an anti-hero, you're just a twat.
Well, this is...
I'm happy to be a twat if that means that, yeah, I have my ticket.
Karma will get you.
Karma's going to drag me down step by step from town to town.
Honestly, it's just, I talk about lavender haze, it's a red crimson haze for me at the moment.
I think it is.
I'm not happy
We
at
may
all.
Have some need to have some kind of intervention before
so
the end
Ben,
of the podcast.
So Ben pre-ordered the Midnight's album, therefore
well
got
my
early
friend
access.
Emma did yeah. So my friend Emma, who is the biggest Swiftie of them all, pre-ordered Midnight's from Taylor's website, which meant that she got the extra early pre-sale code. I mean, we were still like 10,000 or something in the pre-sale queue alone, which is bonkers. But I'll be there at Wembley. But James, you're missing out the bit where I said you can have my
code. That is true.
I will actively help you get these tickets.
That is true. I shouldn't come for Ben just yet. I know that
really
all too
shouldn't.
Well, Ben. All too well.
Yeah.
Yes.
Break so Ben, 10-minute version.
Indeed. Yes. The time. No. So Ben has very kindly said that if he gets drawn for the lottery, because he doesn't need it anymore, he will give me his code.
Yes.
Okay.
And if anyone listening to this has got pre-sale and doesn't need their code, please think of me on Friday as this goes out, because as we record, this is on Thursday. So tomorrow I will find out whether I'm
if your dreams are going to be
on the
crushed or not.
Indeed.
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
His wildest dreams.
Indeed.
His wildest dreams.
I'm quite stressed out about it.
Oh boy. Well, hopefully this will be a nice, calm, relaxing podcast.
Yeah. Let's hope.
Totally calm. Totally relaxing.
I mean, it's not like Hollywood's imploding or anything.
No,
let's
nothing
talk
bad
about,
is happening.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh my God.
Exactly my point. Let's talk about Hollywood is ending. So for anybody who hasn't been keeping up with the news in the last couple of days, as well as the continuing Writers Guild of America East and West Coast strike that has been ongoing now for a couple of months, SAG-AFTRA, the combined Actors Guild, is now also out on strike as of midnight on Wednesday, 8 a.m., Thursday UK time. The Actors Guild are also on strike. This will mean for the duration of the strike, we will have fewer interviews coming your way. I'm going
well,
to be
honest
with you.
They're not technically on strike yet, are they? They are going to go on strike, but isn't there, there's a formality, I seem to recall, as we go out, there's a meeting, isn't there? They have to have the meeting to formalise the strike, don't they, at 5 p.m. this evening.
There's
right,
like
then.
A ticking clock that if it's agreed in time and Tom Cruise can get to the counter with 1 second to go and he hits the button,
then it's off.
But basically, other
it's
than
basically,
that happening,
it's going to. I mean, it is going to happen. It's a formality. It's a formality.
Here's the thing. Yeah, I feel it's fair to say spectacular ill timing. There was a piece in Deadline on Wednesday morning, which came out basically saying the studio plan, and this was, sources cited that were close to UMPTPA, which is the sort of overall studio organization that's been negotiating.
The evil Amptpa.
The evil Amptpa. obviously, we're not saying they're evil, but they are. They basically seem to have briefed Deadline, or somebody involved in their camp seems to have briefed Deadline going, we plan to wait the writers out. They're going to be losing their homes by October, and that is fine with us. And then we will enter into negotiations, maybe running up to a very cold Christmas for them. And that will ensure that they basically come to the table and accept whatever we're willing to give
them. I mean, that's a spectacular thing to say. And it's like, did I say that out loud?
Yeah, I don't know about
yes,
you guys,
you did.
But they sound like the good guys to me.
Are we the baddies?
100%. It was a proper kind of fucking hell. It's a Michelin Web moment.
I think it was meant to be intimidating, and the almost universal response I've seen from writers has been, well, you can, you know, pleasure yourselves with that.
Yeah.
Right.
Well,
now.
The meme that I really like was the Avengers meme, where he's just like, we're going to hold out until you go broke. And then it's like Mark Ruffalo goes, that's my secret. I'm always broke.
That is genuinely what the answer from a lot of them has been. It's like, you have trained us to go months without being paid.
Yeah.
We're okay with that now. So anyway, and obviously for any, you know, for any SAG negotiators who were still wondering how that was going to go, that I imagine would have also galvanized their opinion.
Yeah.
And it also means, of course, that, you know, productions that maybe were continuing around the world with non US writers, but US stars,
yeah,
those are now no longer going.
No. And so, let's be honest, like if you're talking, it's fine, are UK actors, but like you're looking for UK actors who in no way act in the US, right?
Yeah.
Like, and that's not that many. So it really does impact a huge amount of people.
It does, and it is, look, you know, if you're one of the people out there who works in production, who works, you know, in filmmaking, it is going to be, I imagine, tough for you. I'm sorry about that. We don't mean to sound flippant about that at all. We do, however, think that this is a conversation that needs to be had clearly with the studios, because people are not being able to sustain themselves with a career in filmmaking, and that seems like it's a problematic thing.
Let's just say we have sympathy for people who are struggling to maintain a certain lifestyle through the power of writing.
Yes,
I have sympathy for that.
As do I.
Yes, we have to. It obviously involves a lot of empathy and reaching out of our own
imagination.
That's right. Oh my God.
We'll get back to the power of imagination later in this podcast.
Yeah. It's quite a thing. But also, so it may come to the point where, for example, we're just interviewing random people off the streets in podcasts as they go forward.
Yeah.
Because they've moved. So I'm going to the Oppenheimer premiere this evening. But they've moved the red carpet forward by an hour so that the stars of Oppenheimer can do the red carpet. Because when the strike, when this meeting happens at the tail end of the day, when that gets rubber stamped, they're going to have to essentially leave.
Yeah.
Like, that's it. They're done. They can't.
Again, that's kind of thematically great for Oppenheimer. We're against a ticking clock before doomsday hits. Get all the actors out.
The strike bomb is exploding. Yeah.
Yeah. It is unusual times. I think it's the first time in 60 years that both guilds have been out at once. This does mean that more productions will shut down. There are going to be more delays into films that you were looking forward to. We'll be reporting on some films today that are in production, and they will now be sitting around waiting either to go into production or to continue to production. So we saw, for example, and we'll talk about this later in more depth, but, you know, Deadpool images coming out this week. Unless those were rap images, that is now on hiatus, I would say, until this is all resolved. So, you know, best of luck for a wonderful outcome for everybody involved, but especially the writers and actors.
Yes.
Anyway, time for a question. We do have questions sometimes on this podcast, I swear. Rather thematically, this comes from @NandySelson. And Sandy says, the actors and writers are on strike, so it's just directors left. Who are the best multi-hyphenate directors who could single-handedly break the strike by doing all the jobs? Now, let us be clear. We are not about to suggest that any of the names we're about to mention actually would cross the picket line. We do not suggest that they are scabs in any way. This is just a lol question. So who has the talent to break the strike by doing all of the things? Him or herself?
Ooh.
Go.
I mean, immediately, Benson and Moorhead jump to mind. Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead, who made The Endless and who made Something in the Dirt, and yeah. Resolution. Mm-hmm. They write the theme tune, they sing the theme tune, genuinely. They play the roles, often named after themselves, yep. for scripts that they've written, that they direct themselves, sometimes in their own apartments.
Yeah, they have more hyphens than I think any other filmmakers alive. So
they might be the multiest hyphenates.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's interesting. Yeah. Who is the multiest hyphenate? I mean, because I was going to say somebody like Robert Rodriguez, for example, who famously came up doing his own cinematography, his own editing, his own
I think he has
directing.
Like a green screen in his own garage.
He does, yeah.
Who doesn't?
Who doesn't? I mean, yeah, was it Dick Van Dyke got one at one point to train with it?
Well, he'd have an LED volume these days.
Oh, these days, of course, yeah.
Honestly, I think TV will be absolutely fine because Taylor Sheridan exists. And I think while Taylor Sheridan exists and already makes, let's say, 90-95% of all shows on television and acts and produces and writes and directs, I think TV will be entirely unaffected.
Does he do all those things?
Well, no, he does.
He has in different places. In different places.
He has at times done all of those things. Whether does he do all those things now?
Well, no, not enough. But what I'm just saying is, like, bearing in mind that Taylor Sheridan is a guy who I historically just knew as Deputy Hale from Sons of Anarchy. And then he wrote Sicario and Hell or High Water and created the whole Yellowstone verse, which, let's be honest, is most of television at the moment. Mm. It's incredible.
I mean, I would mention the other multi-hyphenate Taylor, but I don't want to set James off again.
I mean, look, she directs, look, she's directing, acts. She acts, she writes, you know, she can do everything. She can do the soundtrack.
Yeah, okay, so Taylor Swift, genuinely a more credible answer than I expected.
I'm pitching for her to be on the cover of the next issue.
Taylor Sheridan, there was an interesting article with him a couple of weeks ago, and I think Esquire, I recommend people read that for a really stunning insight into his mind. James, I'm amazed you haven't mentioned James Cameron yet.
But he doesn't act. Therein lies the problem.
He doesn't need actors?
I mean, do you know what? You actually make a very good point. He lives in a post-actor world where, because like he directs, he writes, he can do sort of like production design. He does all the, you know, sketches everything out. He can do sets. He can do the cinematography. I think he can do everything other than act on screen. But he could 100% invent some kind of technology, which means he doesn't even need actors.
I mean, what it is, it means that if he can't have any like Na'vi actors for whatever Avatar is shooting right now, give us the fucking Piacan movie. Well, Piacan the Tulkun.
You can't say Piacan without, you can't spell Piacan without AI, as Chris would say. So.
Why? You can.
He's
there's
not
no
here.
I in Piacan.
He's not here. We could have done an entire pod without that joke.
We could have done. I feel like I'm channeling him.
I've warned you not to play with these eldritch powers, okay? Like, that is not okay.
Well, you definitely can't spell Na'vi without AI, so, okay, you know, we can have true. AI Na'vi in Avatars 4 and 5.
So who else? Any other multi-hyphenates that you want to mention?
Kevin Smith could hop on and do something. He writes, he directs, he silently acts.
Quentin Tarantino.
Oh, no, we don't want Quentin Tarantino acting. I don't think he's listening, but Quentin, you're so good at so many things.
And that's not one of them.
But the thing that immediately springs to mind more than anything else is the Django Unchained sequence.
He doesn't have to do an accent. He could not do an accent.
He could not.
Which director told him to do that accent? Oh, yeah, it was Quentin Tarantino.
Okay, yeah,
that's fair.
That's fair. That's fair. Fair. Yeah. Mm, yeah. All right. Okay, but we've
Greta Gerwig. She writes, she directs, she acts.
That's
this
true.
Would be the Greta Gerwig indie movie that people are kind of hoping for. Sneak in before she does Narnia stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and again, just to be clear, we're not suggesting any of these people would cross the line. We're just, you know, talking about multi-hyphenates who are a thing that exists. People know stuff about filmmaking. It's kind of cool. I mean, James Cameron, like, famously could do anybody's job on set.
Yeah.
As, you know, so
which
I think
is what makes him
like...
so difficult to work with.
Yes, because he can literally do your job better than you can,
yeah.
and if you screw up, that's embarrassing. Yeah, but you do make a compelling case as well for your pair. So Benson and Moorhead,
knocking it out of the park. Every
we've
time.
Established all films for the next however many months will be Benson and Moorhead production starring Taylor Swift. Excellent, good. I'm on board with this.
Wow,
into
okay.
it.
All right, well,
the silver lining.
Thank you for that question, Nancy. If you'd like to get in touch and have your question treated with the same level of incisive debate and discussion.
And research. I like to think
research.
The deep, deep, deep research.
Chris would want us to mention John Carpenter because he composed his own scores and so on as well. I'm just saying.
Yeah. Werner Herzog. As good in front of the camera as he is behind.
And we could have, like, to be fair, we could have great docs, right? Because I mean, sometimes docs are scripted, but if you just had, you know, a sort of a doc that tells the story through an assemblage of footage, do you get around writing credits that way? It's possible, maybe. If you'd like to get in touch and have your question treated with the same level of completely incisive, deeply researched off the top of our head shit, then please do get in touch with us. Really, the only thing that happens is you need to look out for a panicked shout out from either myself or Chris on a Thursday. Do reply with the hashtag Empire Podcast, or we might not see it. And yes, we will do our best to, you know, answer some questions. Time, I think, now for some news. So apart from the strike, which I feel like we've somewhat covered,
yeah,
what has been happening this week?
Well, the Emmy nominations were announced this week. I am going to spare you and all of our listeners the pain of listening to me go through these category by category. For that, you want to tune into the Pilot TV podcast on
there
Monday.
It is.
But I will say that Obi-Wan Kenobi was nominated for Best Limited Series. And what the fuck?
It's a good show.
It wasn't bad.
It was a good show.
I mean, look, I can... It was fine, but like, are we really saying it was worthy of an Emmy in that category? Like, technical categories, sure, the LED volume as hidden by the houseplants was great, but I just, honestly...
What else was... Do give us that category. What else was
nominated?
Right,
I'll have to bring
category?
It up. I'll have to bring up the category. So it's Best Limited or Anthology Series. It was up against Beef on Netflix, which is amazing.
Uh-huh.
Dharma, the Jeffrey Dahmer story on Netflix, which is a show. Daisy Jones and the Six, which is actually quite surprising,
yeah,
the category on Prime Video.
Uh-huh.
Fleischman is in Trouble, very, very good.
Oh, yeah.
FX. And Obi-Wan Kenobi on Disney+. I just, it's not even the fucking best Star Wars show out last year. Admittedly, it is a limited one, which Mandalorian isn't.
Yeah.
But I was just like,
Andor is
the best.
Yeah, not limited either. And also, does that fall into that? I mean, actually, it's true, because Andor is up for other things. That's very true.
Okay.
Andor's fabulous. But, yeah,
what you tripped over.
I tripped over this and the fact that The Bear was classed as a comedy, which...
That's a weird thing. TV needs to sort its shit out of what's a comedy and what's like a half-hour drama that occasionally makes you smile.
Film doesn't get to tell people off for that.
Well, wasn't The Martian nominated for the best comedy?
Yeah, that was a comedy, yeah.
Like, what? I mean, there's a couple of good... The space pirate gag made me laugh. It's not fucking comedy, is it?
It's very funny.
Yeah, but no, it's not a comedy.
It's not a comedy, no.
It's just funny.
Yeah.
And when he grows potatoes in his own shit, it's hilarious.
It's
when
hilarious.
I do it, apparently it's horrible.
It's frowned upon in the office, certainly. I find that it's that kind of strategic category positioning.
It's category fraud.
And I feel that The Bear is so good, it doesn't need a fraudulent category.
But hang on. So The Bear isn't up for a limited series, is it?
No, The Bear is up for Best Comedy Series.
Okay, right, got you. Yeah,
and
that's fine.
I would argue that, again, while it is funny, it is not a comedy. It is an incredibly stressful half-hour drama.
I think they should just make up their own categories and be like, the most delicious show on telly is Bear. The Bear, not Beef.
Go the sort of Weird Al Yankovic route in that movie, in Weird. You know, maybe not technically the best, but certainly the best known person in this weirdly specific category is... That's how you want to win.
Yeah.
Obi-Wan, best snoot horse in
best
a limited series.
Horse.
In a limited
series.
And you know what? We wouldn't be arguing about that.
No.
It is clearly the best snoot horse.
Best casting of a young Princess Leia. She's
great.
Got it in the bag.
She's lovely.
I mean, does she?
Yeah.
Vivian Lyra Blair was so great in that show. She was wonderful.
Your mileage may vary. Anyway, right.
Anyway.
Look,
anyway,
that was
that's
the thing
not
that happened.
Movies.
Emmy's right. You can hear about more about that on the Pilot TV podcast.
Okay, that's your two mentions. That's it. That's done.
Oh, you wait till I get to the live show.
Oh,
but
boy.
Actually, we should talk news-wise. We have an Empire live show on the 9th of September at King's Place at the London Podcast Festival. Helen's gesticulating wildly, meaning she was going to get to that. But carry on.
That.
All right,
yes.
Go on then. Take it away.
Well,
what were you going to say?
You just said it. We've got a live show as part of the London
Come
Podcast Festival.
Come and see us live.
Come and see us live on September the 9th.
Yes.
We like to think of it as the big, you know, headliner slot on the Saturday night. That may not technically be what it is,
and
but that's the way we see it.
And it's exclusive because it's not going out as a podcast. So if you don't come, you will never, ever
You'll
witness
never
it.
Never know. If you
ever.
Are a podcast completist, this is the only way to hear this one.
It's going to be mega. It's going to be amazing. There is, unfortunately, so as we've discussed earlier, there are some hoops you need to jump through to get Taylor Swift tickets. There are hoops you need to jump through to get tickets for this as well. Yes, you can go to the King's Place website and search for The Empire Podcast,
the Empire Podcast,
on the Podcast Festival. But you are only eligible to buy tickets if you have already bought tickets for the Pilot TV 250th episode, which is on the 19th of August. So you cannot buy tickets for Empire until you have bought tickets for Pilot 250 on the 19th of August.
Okay.
James, you've got to stop sliding into people's DMs like, this is your code to buy a ticket for a pilot.
That's it.
For the
that's
pilot
it.
Show.
This is your exclusive code, only for you. You are eligible.
Yes. James
to
Rules
be,
is
to
the
be
code.
To be clear, there is a Pilot Live podcast on August
is
19th.
Is there? Tell us about it.
Yes, and I'm sure it'll be wonderful, and people should definitely have a look at going to that.
Yes.
But the two are not linked.
kingsplace.co.uk/pilot250.
As your lawyer, the two are not linked and people don't have to go to Pilot in order to come to Empire. I'm just saying, in case anybody's busy one day, maybe with her dad's birthday and still wants to come to the other one.
But your dad's coming, Helen. I don't understand.
Well, I haven't broken the news to him yet, and he's still trying to recover from last year.
Do you know what he would love? Is this on the 9th?
No, the 19th.
Okay, the 19th of August for mine. Yes.
Yes.
And also, if you're around on the 9th at 11:30 in the morning, at the opposite of the headline slot, you maybe want to come and see Disneyversity and see us talk about Shrek.
Ooh,
it's going to be great.
Shrek.
Hang on.
We're doing Shrek.
Disneyversity.
Disneyversity, yes. And you're doing Shrek.
We're doing Shrek.
I have
Please notes. Explain. See, you're working.
So when we do our live shows, we step a little bit outside of the Disney
canon. That's not a little bit outside.
No, that's very outside.
It's very relevant. Last time we did Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Yeah, that's relevant.
Which has direct Disney connections. Yeah. And it was like the part of the timeline that we were at, and it included lots of the characters. This, we spent our most recent run of episodes doing the Renaissance, the Disney Renaissance. Jeffrey Katzenberg, a key figure, a key insane Diet Coke chugging figure
through the Disney Renaissance. Look at you being sneaky.
Then he leaves the studio, sets up DreamWorks,
makes Shrek.
SKG, Spielberg, Katzenberg, Geffen.
Correct.
And makes Shrek, and they quite literally smear shit all over the Disney legacy and basically change the course of Disney's next 20 years. So it's relevant.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, Disneyversity doing Shrek, 11:30, Saturday morning.
So you can make a day of it as you want. But again, just to be clear, as both of your lawyers, you do not have to buy tickets to all three of these shows in order to come to any one of them, okay? I just want to make that clear. Anyway, that's our news section, our self-serving news section for ourselves. Done. By the way, new issue of Empire came out on sale last week. It's still on sale everywhere.
It is.
Do go and have a look. It's a very good issue. I was just reading about Rebel Moon.
That's not Rebel Moon. It's a magazine.
Also this week, there were some very exciting trailers. Now, I know you're going to be chomping at the bit to talk about one of them, Ben. I wanted to start with Napoleon, though.
Ooh.
Because it came out first, and it's, you know, chronological.
It was dynamite. I loved it.
Ooh la la, it was très bien.
Très bien, voilà. It was, of course, the first real look we've had at Ridley Scott's Napoleon biopic, which has Joaquin Phoenix as the Empereur himself, and Vanessa Kirby as the Empress Josephine, and a whole heap of extras being blown up with cannons.
You come to this podcast, I assume, for like analysis and for intelligent commentary on movies. My main thought is, oh my God, this looks big.
It does, doesn't it?
Like crazy big.
Crazy big, crazy French, all of that good stuff.
Because Ridley did like historical drama not too long ago with The Last Duel, which had a couple of like epic battly bits as well as obviously lots of one-on-one fighting. But it wasn't like a big load up the cannons, send in the horses, swoosh the swords around, let's go on a lake and fall through the ice. Like big battle sequences, shooting at the pyramids and all sorts of mad stuff.
Honestly, the part of me felt just physically sick at seeing the destruction of a beloved wonder of the world. But, you know, it's fine.
I mean, he wasn't going to destroy it with just a gun. Like, you know, I feel like we're okay with that one. They're still there.
They are still there. Spoiler. You know. The pyramids still exist.
Yeah, it's very much a return to kind of the duelists era from very early in his career, but on a much bigger scale.
It feels like it has that kind of gladiatorial scale to it, which just, and you know, I wasn't quite sure what to expect from this. And I had a little bit of trepidation, but this, by the end of this trailer, I was like, oh, sign me up for the cannons and the ice and the people falling through and the drama.
I mean, what the ice scene shows, of course, is that he fell prey to one of the classic blunders, which, as we all know, from The Princess Bride.
Never stage a land war in Asia.
Never get involved in a land war in Asia. Yes, correct. And genuinely, that is a classic military blunder. But yeah, I have a couple of tiny, maybe not quibbles or worries about it. Number one, it seems to be covering a whole heap of his life. And, you know, that could end up feeling kind of baggy and loose and also just baffling if you jump about too much on the timeline and try and fit too much in, because he did have an extraordinary convoluted rise to power and then, you know, time on the throne and everything else. I'm also not entirely comfortable with them casting somebody 13 years younger as Josephine, his wife, when she was very famously older. Like, it's not always a big issue. I know how Hollywood works. I get it. I realize also that Joaquin Phoenix will be playing Napoleon throughout his life. However, I don't think that means you need to cast somebody younger than he is as Josephine, because you could also get someone to play a different age. It is really slightly annoying to me and slightly a missed opportunity, actually. And then, yeah, I guess, you know, I didn't notice a lot of Greenwich in there. So it's going to be fun for those of us who come from Southeast London to sit and watch, Greenwich. Greenwich, also Greenwich, another part of Greenwich. The Painted
Pyramids,
Hole is in there.
Pyramids, also Greenwich.
Probably also Greenwich, honestly, I'm not ruling it out. But yeah, the Painted Hole is in there and various views of the Old Royal Naval College.
Cafe Rouge at one point. It was at the Picture House, which is lovely, lovely,
lovely
picture house.
Lovely picture house, the Dark Sugar, the Great Chocolate Shop.
Ooh, very good ice cream. No wonder he invaded there. I think this, as somebody who sometimes finds this stuff like a bit dry, the film itself or the trailer doesn't sell it as a dry history movie. It makes it look like an exciting and slightly off-kilter tonally, like a slightly punky edge to the editing and to the sort of framing of the story itself. I think it's just a joy as well to see Ridley Scott at the age of 85. Still making mega, mega movies like this. And he's obviously pivoting straight from this into Gladiator 2. Yeah. He is still like massive level of ambition. And that the writer of this, David Scarpa, has also written the screenplay for Gladiator 2. So he has a really good sort of setup with this guy, presumably. I'm really intrigued to see what this film ends up being for its own thing, because a Ridley Scott big historical war epic is something to be very excited about, but also as a bit of a warm-up for Gladiator 2, which I'm tentatively hopeful for.
Yeah. Gladiator 2, Maximus Velocity.
Oh, yes.
What was it? What was the name of the Fast movies in Japan?
Wild Speed.
Wild Speed, but what's the one with Maximum in the title?
Wild Speed Max was Fast and Furious.
Right.
Wild Speed Mega Max was...
Okay.
Fast Five.
Wild Speed Mega Max.
Can we do it? Can we do a then Gladiator Mega Maximus? Would that work?
Yes. Yes. I mean, they already did Rome in Fast 10.
Hey.
And I was entertained when Vin Diesel drove into the crane and the crane hit a bomb and the bomb went in the water. And then
no spoilers.
Amazing.
We will discuss Roman car chases a little bit later in the show. A little bit of a hint there to what might be getting an in-depth review this week. It's Mission Impossible. I'm very excited about Napoleon. I can't wait to see it. The other big, big trailer this week, of course, was Wonka. This is the prequel that literally no one was asking for to the story of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, the story of how Willy Wonka became a major chocolatier. They cast Timothée Chalamet in the lead role and Paul King as director. And suddenly we were like, I mean, maybe that's great. And then this trailer happened and revealed also our first look at Hugh Grant as, I think, all the Oompa Loompas.
Yeah. At least an Oompa Loompa.
At least an Oompa Loompa.
That is bonkers.
It is bonkers.
No, it's wonkers.
It is. It is. Yeah. Crazy choice. But I love that for Paul King, who, you know, he chose making this over making Paddington 3, which is a huge move.
Mm.
But I don't know. There's something here when you watch this trailer. You go, okay, I can see a bit of the Paddington DNA, definitely a bit of Harry Potter.
Very much so. A few crossers of overs of actors from the Paddington movies,
including Sally Hawkins,
who's been poached from the Paddington movies. Yeah,
she has. Yeah, so she won't be in Paddington in Peru, but she is here as Wonka's mum in a brief shot in the trailer. Mm-hmm. And yeah, like loads of great British comedians, Patterson Joseph from Peep Show, Olivia Colman, also from Peep Show, other people who aren't in Peep Show, Matthew Bainton,
Keegan-Michael Key, who isn't British, but you know, it seems to be having fun. Great.
Paul King, it makes sense. I think initially we were scratching our heads of like, why is he doing this? Why is he not doing Paddington 3? But something that takes, you know, British iconography of stories that informed all of our childhoods and making it kind of new and relevant but nostalgic and whimsical, you know, it makes sense. Yeah, I can see the vision when I see this trailer. I think I want to see a little bit more of like the musical side of the film, because we see some dancing in the trailer, some like big dance numbers, and we know that this is at least in part a musical.
Yeah, Neil Hannon
from the Divine Comedy is writing the songs, and Paul King has spoken quite a bit about how the 1971 Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory was a big influence for him, for what the world is, the European influence of the town, but also
the pure imagination, if you will,
the
of the songs.
Pure imagination that there's people drowning in chocolate, there's people eating chocolate and flying, but also that, yeah, that the 71 film was kind of a musical and then sort of stops being a musical. And then, you know, I think he's trying to do a similar thing here. But we don't hear any singing. We don't hear what the songs are going to sound like.
I went to a sort of launch event for the trailer of this. Now, first of all,
like?
It was super good. There was a chocolate fountain. There was an entire wall of like pick and mix, which you don't usually get for free. There was a person selling flavored, or not selling, giving away flavored, what do you call that stuff?
Candy floss?
Candy floss, yes. Canapes were going around. Like, it was
candy pays.
They had not spared on this. This was a major kind of event,
and
then they literally just showed us a trailer, and so I was very sugared up at the time. Do bear that in mind. I thought the trailer was overly twee, and I didn't really get what it was going for until I saw the Hugh Grant bit. But then Paul King came out and said, like, he's saying the right things. It sounds super good the way he describes the film he's made. And I thought back and I remembered the first Paddington trailer was not as gorgeous as the film.
Yeah, and I think this is what gives me hope. Like, I could give the first fuck about Willy Wonka, but but genuinely, I felt a little bit the same way about Paddington before the first Paddington came out.
Paddington was a meme. Creepy Paddington was a meme because of the trailer for the first film.
That was created by Ollie Gibbs from Empire.
Don't out him. Yes, that was, it's absolutely true. But he made us fall in love with that character.
Yeah.
All over again, or for some of us for the very first time. So if you can pull the same trick with Willy Wonka, I mean, it's a long shot, but it's possible. And, you know, if it takes Muad'Dib to sling spice chocolates to do it, I'm here for it.
Can I just say that Timothée Chalamet on Twitter announced this trailer with the simple tweet, Humpa Loompa Dupity Grant. All in capital letters, no further comment, no link to the trailer, no embed.
I think it was his first tweet in like 5 months.
There isn't a wasted, you know, wasted letter or wasted syllable. No. That is a perfect tweet. Well done to Timothée Chalamet. What more does he need, honestly?
And to say, obviously, if you're listening to this, chances are you weren't at the delicious, delicious event that Helen got to go to for this, but we did a trailer breakdown interview with Paul King that is on the website right now, where we talked about casting Timothée Chalamet and what he's taking from the book and what he's taking from the 71 film and the casting of Hugh Grant, all sorts of stuff. He got into loads of detail and named characters who there isn't really much stuff out there about at the moment. So go and read that. That's on empireonline.com. And it was by me.
It was.
So
it was,
I hope you enjoy it. And if you don't, don't tell me.
Yeah.
Fair.
That's absolutely fair. What else was in the news this week? There was, very excitingly, a picture posted on Ryan Reynolds' Instagram account from, I think it's, we're still calling it Deadpool 3. We'll see if that name sticks. But it showed Deadpool with Wolverine. And what was exciting about it, apart from the fact that Wolverine was in it, which I personally, that's 10 out of 10, no notes. He's wearing yellow and blue, people. He is in a traditional Wolverine comic faithful costume.
Yes, he is, as they riffed on it in the first X-Men film. What did he want? Yellow spandex? Yes, he did. And now he has it.
Only took 23 years. But here we are. Yeah, it's a cool pick. I mean, like, seeing the bright red Deadpool suit next to the yellow Wolverine suit, they kind of pop off each other. It looks cool. My main worry is that we know what happens when you get Wolverine and Deadpool together in a film during a writer's strike. We know what the result of that ends up being.
We've only got one example, okay? That is not enough for a scientific hypothesis.
But it was
hypothesis.
Such a bad example,
I think,
Helen.
His mouth will be in this film.
Yeah, but who's writing the lines that he's saying, James?
No. I mean, does he need a script? In my experience of Ryan Reynolds, it's optional.
Look, here's the thing, right? We now know, assuming that that wasn't a wrap picture and we have no reason to believe that it was, shooting is now presumably suspended.
Yeah.
Okay? So if they have time, right? If there was anything that they wanted to change during the last 2 months and they weren't able to because nobody could write, they have time. The chances are, history does suggest that both of these strikes are likely to be resolved at some point in a fairly short space of time, as in the two strikes are likely to come together, you know, at a certain point and both be ended within a short space of time. I'm not saying they'll be short strikes. And that means that presumably the writers and the actors go back to work at around hopefully the same time. And therefore, if anything needs to be zhuzhed, it can be zhuzhed. But what doesn't need to be zhuzhed is Hugh Jackman in that outfit? Yes, thank you.
He's got the pointy hair
he's
as well.
Got
he's got little
hair
points. This at least justifies a bit, because I think, obviously, you know, we like the Deadpool movies enough that I think they're all right. Ryan Reynolds is very good at doing this stuff, but the Logan send-off was so good that there really was a question of, like, is this the right move? Seeing Hugh in the yellow costume is a bit of a, okay, I guess you never got to do this.
Yeah, it's like,
and this could be something different and worth seeing.
Okay, this feels distinct from everything that's gone before. It doesn't feel like this is... And honestly, Logan didn't feel entirely like it was related to what he'd done before. So I feel like this can exist in its own universe. Speaking of its own universe, also in this film we learned this week, is apparently Jennifer Garner as Elektra.
That's wild.
And no one saw that coming. I don't care who you are out there. I do not believe you saw that coming. You're going to have to show me a dated letter to yourself saying, I predict Jennifer Garner will be in Deadpool 3, because otherwise I'm not going to believe it.
Do we think Ben Affleck is going to make an appearance as
Deadpool? That's what a lot of people have speculated.
I mean... Would that be a thing?
It feels like that could get fraught, right?
It makes me wonder if... Because we don't know what this film really is
yet.
And I do wonder, because they finally have access to all of the Fox characters for the first time, if it might be Deadpool rounding up a bunch of Fox characters to crash into the MCU and be like, hey, what are you going to do? What are we doing?
That would make...
Could be a deal, because there's been bits of rumors that the main one properly reported by reputable sources is the Jennifer Garner bit. But there are rumors of other Fox, you know, from the X-Men movies, but a bit of Fantastic Four and, Daredevil, Elektra stuff being in the mix potentially for Deadpool 3 as well. Which would be interesting.
I mean, there is a photo online, I hope and believe this is not a spoiler, which appears to show the sort of ruins of the Fox logo, as in the big stone one at the beginning of the film, in the background behind Deadpool and Wolverine in those costumes. So that would not seem completely impossible. And also, I mean, even thinking back to the screening, this is a bit inside baseball, but the screening of Deadpool 2, when we went to see that a few years ago, I don't remember, time has no meaning anymore. but they, you know, there's a letter on the screen before the film started, apparently from Deadpool, saying, obviously, please don't post all the spoilers online. But the header of that letter was a crossed out Fox logo with TBD on it. So even at that point, they were making fun of the fact that Fox's ownership was uncertain and that where it ended up remain to be seen. So it kind of feels like it's something that they want to play with.
I mean, it's a good idea for this, right? That if you're going to make a film that is the first film that brings Deadpool into the MCU, you make it about Deadpool crashing into the MCU in some way. Make that the kind of text of the story. That makes me more intrigued for this, because, I like what Ryan Reynolds does, but I don't love those movies.
Yeah.
So cautiously optimistic.
Yeah, I'm optimistic. I'm properly optimistic. I'm a Wolverine stan from way back.
I preferred Wolverine's brown and yellow costume, his sort of solo costume, if I'm perfectly honest with you.
Nerd. I've got those books too, but, you know, come on. We've had Madripoor. I don't need him to stay his entire movie.
I do feel a bit bad, sorry, just for Hugh Jackman, though, because it was like, fine, I'll do it one more time. I'll get like absolutely ripped again and I'll play Wolverine one last time. And now he's got into that shape and he's just going to have to keep eating 10 chickens a day as long as this strike keeps going until he can start shooting again.
He's in many ways the real victim here, along with film journalists who are, of course, the real victims here.
That's very true.
Here it goes. I mean, this is going to segue perfectly because we're about to talk James Gunn and Marvel, and then we're going to go into James Gunn and DC. I couldn't have planned this better, but because James Gunn and Marvel, we've just been talking about Marvel characters, and there was reports this week, there were rumors that the Peter Quill spin-off that seemed to be hinted at the end of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, I guess that in itself is a spoiler, but, beyond that, I don't know how to cover this, but apparently James Gunn has been talking this week and said, we always wanted to give somebody a little something special. Chris and I forever have talked about how great it would be to do a legendary Star-Lord movie with him on Earth trying to adapt to Earth in the same way that anyone else might try to adapt to an alien environment in space. And apparently that's something that might actually happen, presumably not soon, given everything. But that is what he's been kind of talking about, apparently. And that's the reason for that Star-Lord will return card at the end
of the film. It's funny, I love the character and I'd like to see more of him. Weirdly, that's not the environment that most appeals to me. that kind of inverse sort of fish out of water thing. I love the galactic nature of the Guardians films, the fact that they're batshit and bonkers and colourful and cosmopolitan, have all these different aliens and crazy shit in them. Mm-hmm. And I think when you strip all that out and you have an Earthbound thing, I'm sure he'll find a way to weave this stuff in, but it feels like it lacks some of the crucial, you know, je ne sais quoi.
The other issue is it presumably wouldn't be James Gunn in charge of it.
Also true.
What we're about to get
into.
Well,
indeed.
Yeah.
I like the idea, though, of a two-hour movie of Star-Lord discovering Spotify. He's just, like, listening to decades of music. And I am not affiliated with the WGA, so I can write that. I can write an outline, if you want. I can write the track list. I would be happy
Amazing.
To do that.
Amazing. You're such a giver.
I'm
you really are.
I'm a philanthropist at heart.
Well, we spoke of James Gunn, and that brings us, of course, to Superman Legacy, which he is working on over at DC. So there was a lot of casting announced this week. So first of all, somebody who I feel like was in superhero conversations, Superman conversations, not that long ago, but it's, you know, we're let's be honest, very old now. But Nathan Fillion mm-hmm. is apparently in talks to join the cast. Isabella Merced and Ed Gathegi are joining. And then there came the word that Barry's Anthony Carrigan
yes.
would be joining. I mean, I don't wish to profile, but would he perhaps be up for Lex Luthor?
Well, no, he's the character he's attached to has been named, haven't they?
That's
yeah,
right.
I believe
yeah.
it has. And it's not, despite his magnificent bald head, he won't be Lex Luthor. He's going to be Metamorpho, who is a deeper cut
absolutely
than
heard of.
I am aware of.
Yeah.
So he's an archaeologist turned hero called Rex Mason in his nom de non-superhero, and can transmute elements in his body into various forms, taking those properties as powers. Starts off on the path of heroism, became a detective and a founder member of the Outsiders. Well, I'll be honest, that is a deeper cut.
Yes, it is. Although Nathan Fillion's going to be Green Lantern and we've all heard of him, so that's good.
Yes. I am familiar, yes. Let us hope for a happier experience for his Green Lantern than others who played the character.
Indeed.
Isabel Merced will be Hawk Girl and Gathegi is going to be Mr. Terrific. What's a character name?
I mean, James Gunn is making good on his word of like, oh, I'm going to dig out some of the weirder characters that DC has not made use of on the big screen. And he has track record of making those into household names.
Mr. Terrific is definitely one of them.
Hey, he's a skilled warrior and one of the world's most brilliant tacticians and inventors, I'll have you know.
I would hope so with that name.
But yeah, that's, and Hawk Girl, you know, we've had some Hawk experience recently in the DC universe.
Yeah. Who's the Hawk guy in Black Adam?
Hawkman,
the Hawk. A Hawk?
The
Street Hawk.
Oh boy.
I don't know.
Tony Hawk's Pro Skater 2.
I don't remember what his name is, but he's definitely got Hawk-like properties.
Good Lord.
He wasn't the Falcon. He was a different kind of bird.
Jeez. He is Hawkman.
Hawkman! Yes. There you go.
And he was played by Aldous Hodge.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
It's almost, I mean, how they come up with these names. He looks like a hawk. He's a man. I've got it. Wait for it, guys.
I mean, it still took you like 20
that
tries.
Is true. That is true.
Is there any other news as we all batten down the hatches for a long night of waiting for?
Yeah, that's a good point. This may be the last bit of news for a while. We should find some. Mm.
Well, there was a Blue Beetle trailer as well, which emphasized or tried to emphasize that it will be fun and not angsty. I feel like these trailers are giving away a whole lot of that film.
Yeah, it does give that impression, doesn't it?
So, every day is Christmas Eve. I'm really hoping for the best for it. But it's in that weird limbo between DC regimes, and which has not, you know, helped the last couple of DC films. So, you know, at this point, I just hope it kind of breaks that cycle a little bit and breaks out.
We have one more trailer that we haven't discussed, which has made my week, which is the Ahsoka trailer.
Oh my God, I can't believe we've
talked about
that.
It looks so good.
It does look amazing.
It looks so good. And as a newly minted Rebels fan, I was already getting really excited about seeing those characters hopping across to live action, but there is stuff stated or mentioned in this trailer particularly that made me go, when I watched this at home. There was nobody around to hear me loudly gasp, but you probably could have heard it from about a mile away when Sabine Wren, the Mandalorian who is part of the Ghost crew, one of the main characters from Rebels who's kind of porting across to live action here, played by Natasha Lou Bordizzo, she refers to Ahsoka as master, as in she was being trained by Ahsoka in an unspecified period of time, presumably post the Rebels epilogue. Between then and now, the start of this show, there is a lot of history there because we've seen her with Ezra Bridger's green lightsaber. He is off missing somewhere, having been transported halfway across the galaxy by the big old space whales, the Purrgil, who you see in this trailer. They look absolutely gigantic and ethereal, and we get a proper look at Thrawn for the first time. I was one of those lucky people who got to see Thrawn's face at Celebration when they showed like an extended version of the trailer at the room in Celebration. So I had seen his face already. As people have pointed out, it's Lars Mikkelsen with a blue face. Some people seem to think he looks a bit like Elon Musk. We're going to gloss over that.
They're not wrong.
They're not wrong.
Yeah. He does. Very much.
But it's a great trailer.
It is a great trailer.
It looks really exciting. It looks like a really good mix of... There's a lot of emotional undercurrents that come with this long-running character. Well, the Ray Stevenson stuff especially, because... Yeah. Again, I was lucky enough to speak to him at Celebration, and he was so full of energy talking about this show and talking about getting a lightsaber and how he immediately was swinging it around and going vroom, 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 then felt a bit embarrassed about it. And they were like, don't worry, everybody does that. He was so thrilled to be in the show, to be in the role that he was playing. So that is absolutely going to have some emotional heft to it. Mm. But also for Ahsoka, for this really long-running character, to, you know, get her own show, and for all these characters that people have a lot of attachment to from the animated series coming through, it's going to have a lot of emotional heft. At the same time, it is a big, colourful, poppy Star Wars, in a different kind of register to something like Andor.
Yeah, and I think it's good that if they keep mixing it up like that, I think you have to do that. I think Marvel, apart from anything else, has shown them that. If you're going to keep people coming back for different TV shows, different movies, you need to keep each one distinct, give each one its own energy, give each one its own kind of selling points. She looks fantastic as Ahsoka. I'm really excited about that. I'm still traumatized because as someone who has not watched her entire comic book background, I once tried to read the Wikipedia page. It is longer than War and Peace. I swear to God, that is the longest single page of the internet I think I've ever seen.
Anything, so I haven't seen Clone Wars yet, but I've seen all of Rebels. And whenever I've tried to read stuff about Rebels, it's so dense and the amount of information is ridiculous. And then you just watch it in the show and you're like, okay, cool, that makes sense. I get it. Yeah, it's like less effort to end up watching it than it is to read it. If you are like me several months ago and had not seen any of Rebels, around Celebration, I started watching it and I watched the whole thing in a month, which was not even like, oh, I'm going to spend every second of every day watching this. I just, you know, stuck one on, stuck a couple on.
They are short, I guess.
They're quite short. So if you are trying to get caught up for August 23rd, I believe, is the premiere, and it's a 2-episode premiere of Ahsoka. So they're going to drop 2 episodes at the same time, end of August. You do have time, you know, depending on your lifestyle, to catch up on Rebels in that time. It's doable. I did it.
Take you
it
too me. Could watch the whole of the blur before Ahsoka arrives.
And then you'll be as excited as me when Sabine Wren says, master, and you'll go, and everyone will hear it.
Yes. Okay. Look forward to it. But I'm also looking forward to the show. It was a really fun trailer. And even as someone who knows nothing, I am excited to see more. Shall we have a guest?
Why not?
Yeah.
Why not indeed?
Let us enjoy the company of actors while we still have them. Simon Pegg, of course, is an old friend of this parish. He's been a part of the Mission Impossible films also since the third film. And Rebecca Ferguson, of course, joined on the fifth. So who better to come along and tell us everything we could possibly wish to know that isn't a spoiler about the seventh? No one better. There is no one else who could possibly be better because everyone else who could possibly be better was flying off a cliff at the time. So we sent along Chris, of course, to have a chat with them both. So please enjoy.
Hey, everyone, it's Chris here. Just jumping in real quick because you can't get rid of me that easily. But also, I just wanted to tell you that the interview with Simon Pegg and Rebecca Ferguson you're about to hear, while not being a spoiler special interview, does delve into some plot points of Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. So if you haven't seen the film, perhaps it's best to hold off until you have before coming back and listening to this. Of course, if you have seen the film or you don't care a jot about spoilers, then dive on in. This is a very, very fun interview with two people who are having a bit of a giggly day. And me as well. Enjoy.
Welcome to the Empire Podcast, Simon Pegg and Rebecca Ferguson. How are you both?
We are very well, Chris Hewitt.
I mean, good. I am fantastic and excited to be here.
Excellent. We're excited to have you here. Simon, I'm loving your hair.
Thanks. Yeah, I went full Tim Bisley for the press tour.
You did. What was the thinking behind this?
I had the same haircut for 3 years, like because of shooting this movie and being in continuity constantly. And I was just like, you know what? Screw it. I'm going to have blonde hair for the press tour.
I can say that you did it, Rebecca. I'm going to take charge of this one.
Yes.
Because I did it first.
You did do it first.
But no one's asked me about it. I lobbed all of my hair off and I bleached it.
Right. Okay.
Amy just stuck
a wig on you when she
And then they put a wig on. Yeah. But yours is more in our faces.
Amy, our makeup designer, when she saw it at the screening of the film the other night, she just looked at me and her little jaw just dropped. Like, what have you done? Because there's obviously still got things to do.
Yeah, but it's fine. You got it's wigs
not like
and
you
stuff.
Took away a
this
mustache.
Is a spoiler special, isn't it?
No, this is just a general chat. Okay. What was your act of rebellion and the hair? Once you knew that you were not going to be filming Dead Reckoning Part 1 anymore, that was it.
No, I did it before that.
You did it before that?
Yeah.
Oh my God. So it's an act of rebellion in the middle
In the middle. I was like, we were supposed to rap, and then we were supposed to rap, and then we were supposed to rap. And we get to a point where it's like, there's no more rapping unless I rap it myself. And then we kind of lopped it off and colored it. And they were like, that's great. We've got a wig. So if you just come back.
Yeah, you were trying to force like a fait accompli.
I needed to do another show for 2 seconds. But I mean, I kept on shooting. I think I shot a couple of months ago.
Yeah, you did. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like right up to the end.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Right. Are you worried in case McHugh comes crashing in here and tries to film some more?
It could happen.
I love it, though. We embrace it.
We do.
I'm always ready.
Yeah.
It's always fun when you get the call, like you've still got a little bit to do. He was kind of, the most fun we have is when we're on set. Waiting around to go on set can be maddening, but when we're on set, it's just the best.
And what do you do? I've been on set with you. I know that you sit in Jeff quite a lot.
I sit in my Jeff chair.
You luxuriate.
He gave a Jeff chair to all of us.
I did.
No way.
Yeah. We were all given a Jeff chair. Well, actually, Tom and I were given Jeff.
Yeah, I gave you one.
It wasn't on this film. We were less cast.
When me and Tom... Bing and Rebecca are together. When that little foursome is united, it's always a hoot. Because we're like, with the new kids, and I love them all, and they're all brilliant, and they all bring something new. But because we've done like a bunch of, I've done 5, she's done 3, Bing and Tom have done them all.
Yeah. We know it.
We just know the drill. And we get into the room together, and it's just like, we hit the ground running. It's just, it's such a
joy.
And
I also think because we're figuring things out. There is an agenda, there is a story, it's in McHugh's brain. It's about kind of bringing it out and kind of understanding it. But on set, it's kind of, that's where we find it.
Yes.
So we play.
Sometimes I want to hit McHugh in the head to see if the story just falls out repeatedly with an iron bar.
Comes out as a cue card.
Just comes trickling out of his ear. Oh, that's what we're doing. Thanks.
was this easy camaraderie? Was it always there right from the off? And have you guys, or was there like an initiation process, a sort of getting to ease your way into this franchise?
No. Bang, slam, straight on, ma'am.
Yeah. Oh, when I met Rebecca...
Sorry, I can't say that.
Wham, bam, thank you, ma'am.
No, I said that differently.
It was extravagantly wrong, but I loved it.
I know.
What did you say? So it's wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, but you actually said, I think...
This is one of Rebecca's strange Swedish mutilations of a British expression.
It's not even Swedish. It's what I try to think. I don't know.
I remember meeting Rebecca at Leaves and Studios, and she got out of the car, or I got out of my car, and we were introduced for the first time, and she was immediately just ebullient and friendly and fun, and you were. I remember it being, it was quite exciting, because we were starting a new mission film, that's always exciting. Mm-hmm. And you were, new to the series, so that's always fun when you meet the new people.
And I was probably super nervous, and it's Simon Pegg, and it's sort of, who are you amongst all of these already established characters? That's always the question. What can you bring?
So there is a sense of tentativeness on your part.
For me, it's sort of, what can I deliver? What can I deliver to suit the environment? But at the same time, I didn't feel that pressure. It was always there. you know, you're not working against something with Mission, with Tom and McHugh, or even with Simon and Ving. It's all there open for grabs and ideas, and it's a very safe, fun environment. Hence why this works so well. I'm doing shaking my hands and showing Simon Pegg in a physical
Rebecca
motion.
Is shaking her hands. I remember being on the set of Mission 3 when Tom came out. I met Tom for the first time on set. I didn't even meet him before because it was like I came in to do like 2 days, and he walked on set with Ving.
Right.
Both of whom I, you know, obviously were hugely aware of as a fan of film. And they both made me feel so at ease. And I had this massive monologue, which I couldn't get right. I got it the day before, and it was all about the rabbit's foot.
Fucking
and
rabbit's foot.
The anti-god, yeah. All that kind of
desal
stuff.
Desal and icy water.
Desal, that's Rebecca's little mountain she had to climb. But Tom never made me feel like I was fucking up. You know, he never made me feel anxious. All he did was made me feel calm enough to just concentrate
always.
And deliver the lines.
And always ending it with, are you happy?
Yeah, yeah.
Are you happy? Do you want another one?
I mean, that's a big question.
I know, and you go, I don't fucking know. Do I?
I don't know,
you?
Tom, am I happy?
Am I happy, Simon? And Simon's going, yes, you want.
Just say yes. Just say yes.
Am I happy, Tom? Let me lie on Jeff and think about that for a few minutes.
Yeah, now I'm just all about having a nap and playing Candy Crush. It's different times now.
Yeah, it's very, yeah. Very, yeah, it's
barely talk anymore.
Absolutely. So what was your first day and what was your last day on this movie? Avoiding spoilers in case there are any lurking within.
No, because we don't really shoot in orders of things. But I think my first day was, we were in Venice, and it was before the pandemic. And I have a fighting sequence, a sword fighting sequence,
yes,
with Isai Morales. And I have to do a roll up on him and I kill a thigh move. And I think we were going to do that as a first take. And I trained and I was stretching and I was ready. And then they were like, it was like just getting ready to jump. And they went, we have to pause production. We don't know why people are wearing masks. Something's happening.
Shit. You were literally midair when they paused.
Midair. You were like pulled the plug.
Yeah.
And I actually remember my husband was there and we were like, okay, so we're not filming. Should we go skiing? You know, should we leave our daughter?
Do you
remember?
You were going to do that, yeah.
You know, should we leave our daughter and the nanny in the hotel and just go skiing for a week? Not that I go skiing whilst filming films like Mission because I've signed contracts and I would never do such a thing.
It's dangerous.
It's really dangerous.
I never go snowboarding every year in January.
No, you have never gone snowboarding ever.
Never.
No.
Didn't break my finger? No.
Nope. That was my first day. What was your first day?
My first day was the mountain in Norway. That it was that we shot the B-side. I did the offlines. I sat on a camera box behind the camera while Tom was on the edge of the cliff on the motorbike.
Okay.
And I was giving him all Benji's feed lines because, of course, it's Benji that sends him up on that incredible, you know, feat that he has to achieve. Mm-hmm. And then in the afternoon, Tom did the bike stunt four times, I think, that day. And we all stood up there. In fact, everybody came
up.
How did he get up the mountain?
Yeah.
We got up to the mountain in a helicopter.
So he would fly down.
He would jump off, parachute, land,
and then
jump in a helicopter.
Up.
It would bring him up again. That was the reset.
Oh, it's so Tom.
Yeah, I know. And then he would do it again. But I do have footage on my phone of it, which I, as soon as I'm allowed, I'm going to put it on my Instagram.
Yeah,
because it's him going along, and you can hear us all going.
And then, can you imagine? What do you think? Do you think they shot that scene knowing that, you know, it's not a 50-50 that he survives, but
yeah.
It's quite dangerous, even though all the precaution and everything.
Oh, yeah.
We've all seen the scissor reel.
Yeah.
To start it off with that.
Just in case. If we don't shoot loads of the film and then it's like.
The question.
Whoops.
Maybe. Well, so they'll have enough to release just in case.
We did shoot the A4.
A lot of money, you know.
A400?
A400, yeah.
On one of the first days. We tend to do the big stuff first. We get it out of the way. And sometimes it's because it's stressful for Tom. Knowing he's got stuff coming up, you know, like if his mind's on like, oh, I've got to jump off a cliff on a motorbike on Thursday, then Wednesday's going to be useless.
I'm exactly the same.
You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. When you've got to do that kind of thing.
I know.
Yeah.
All the time.
Yeah.
On the way here.
I think he likes that. I think he also, the other thing is the way McHugh writes, you know, all those bits are kind of written in stone. They're meticulously planned, thought out, but we don't always know how they're going to be. How they're going to link with each other.
Yeah.
When we shot the A400 in Rogue Nation, we didn't know if it was the end of the movie or a middle set piece. And in the end, we just stuck it on at the front because we go, oh, I'll get rid of it. Do you know what I mean? Like,
I didn't know how this film started. And I'm not going to mention, I know if we can, but
Oh, the whole thing with the...
With the thingy.
With the basketball, yeah.
Yeah, with the Swiss film. I had no idea until I saw the movie.
What's the submarine called?
The Swiss film.
It's called the Slam Bam, Thank You, Ma'am.
The Slam Bam, Wham Bam, Thank You, Ma'am.
Yeah, I had no idea.
It's a piece of ham.
I also remember in Rogue Nation, there was a moment where I just defibrillated Tom.
Right.
And I'm running out, but we've shot the continuation of it in Morocco.
Yes.
Because we're doing a big
chase
scene.
Yes.
And I run out and I'm sliding over the hood of a car and I'm going to do the sort of thingy-majiggy where you get in with your fingerprint. Mm-hmm. And McHugh goes, oh, wait, stop. You took the thing, right? And I go, what thing? And he goes, well, the thing that is the thing, that is the whole thing, that is humanity can explode kind of thing. Did you get it? And I went, but we don't know what it is, right? And he goes, no, but it's going to be about the size of a lighter. I don't know what it is, but just, Tom, grab, can we do a lighter, guys? And I had to just hold a lighter. Which is basically the key, I think, to the list of important names before they get fastened and killed. And
he just, I mean, McHugh, he's a mystery to me because he holds all this stuff in his head, you know. And at any one time I'll say, so what happens next? And he'll go, I don't know.
Yeah.
And he genuinely doesn't know, but he's such a problem solver. He thrives on being put in a position where he has to solve the problem because he invariably makes the best decision in that situation.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, I've spoken to him a bit about this movie already, and he said that on that first day when Tom, you know, gets on his bike, drives off a fucking ramp, and parachutes down a cliff. I mean, it's you know, typical Wednesday, as you know, but that he knew, they knew that Tom was going to do that, but he didn't know why he was doing that or what he was parachuting onto.
Away from, towards.
Yeah, and he found out as the film went on. Which means, what were your lines then at that point? And did they change your feed lines?
He did. He definitely knew he was trying to get on the train.
Okay.
But we didn't know all the other sort of connective tissue and minor details weren't filled in. It was the bare bones of the piece that was, you know, versatile enough to be able to kind of maneuver into a story.
Yeah. You never know where it's going to be placed either.
No.
So even when we have chasing scenes, it's sort of, you don't have to ask if you're running away or towards something. You're just running. Run.
The first thing I did was
just run.
My first day of actual shooting, I think, or my first day in Venice, I was on a boat. None of it's in the film, annoyingly. I was on the boat and I'm racing to try and find Ethan. And McHugh was just sat on the front of the boat, just going, say, I can't see you. Say, it's on the Fritz. I can't make out where you are. Say, like, he's just throwing.
Oh, it's so McHugh.
And I was like, why am I saying this? What's happening?
Don't ask, just say it. It's gonna be great, trust me.
You do, that's what you have to do. You have to
have
trust
you got
him.
The thing in your hand? It's about yay big.
Yeah, it's big as a lighter. I do trust him implicitly, and I do trust that he will figure it out because he always does.
Yeah.
Times on this one, it felt like we came closest to it not getting figured out, you know, because we were up against it so much and the puzzles just seemed, you know, the obstacles seemed insurmountable, but he always does it.
It works. It works nicely.
Mm-hmm.
Last day on this movie. Rebecca, what was your last day? It was about a week ago.
I actually have a video of it, of that filming for various reasons, but my last moment was, it's the sequence where Ilsa finds the key. It's a tiny little cut where you're filming through a grid and there's a man with a key around his neck and there's a fight sequence of her. Do you remember? It's a very quick flash when they do the storytelling.
Yes, when
and they
the
say,
key.
Oh, Ilsa killed someone and grabbed the key, and you see me do a quick little maneuver in a corridor.
A thingy.
Up the
stairs. And then you shoot him real close, like John Wick style. Yeah, it's so cool.
And then I grab the key and I look down. That was my last. That was my last.
Wow. And was that packed with emotion for you? Or was it very much and then out?
No, it was more of a... That was me showing emotions.
Oh my god. Simon, your last day?
My last day, weirdly,
it's next Thursday.
Has not come yet.
Hasn't come. No, it was on the bomb sequence, funnily enough, in the airport.
Oh.
We came back to that scene many, many times, just because we were sort of like adding little bits and pieces. But there was a line when we originally shot it when the bomb asks Benji a personal question. It's in the moment where the bomb is trying to
figure out who you are.
It's the psychometric test thing. And the question that the bomb asked didn't go down well with the test crowds. They felt.
What was the question? Can I ask?
The bomb asked Benji if he's ever thought about hurting himself or others. It's like a classic question you ask in a psychiatric exam, right?
Oh, like a psychopath.
And Benji says no, and the bomb tells him that he's lied. And so Benji has to admit that he's kind of self-harmed.
Shit.
And the audience fucking hated that idea. They hated the idea that Benji... So we changed the question to, are you afraid of death? Which actually came up with a great moment when he says, who isn't? But yeah, that
oh, that would have had a very dark.
It was too dark. My character score went up like 10% after they took that question out.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Happy you lucky know Benji. Your score?
No, but McHugh told me that was, you know, each character gets a sort of score of people are responding. You know, I'm saying it. I'm saying it for the listener.
What was my score?
Saying it for the listener. Hey, Brian. How's it going?
You were a solid 42.
Okay, great. And, thank you.
No, out of?
100.
Oh, my God.
No, you would have been through the roof, Rebecca. You know everybody loves Rebecca.
God, that's so funny with a question.
But it was because that question was... Yeah. Because
in Benji.
We were getting into this idea of PTSD, and Benji had been almost killed in Fallout.
Yeah.
Ilsa saved his life. And we were talking about how this has weighs on him, you know, and how he was kind of close to the edge. In a few earlier iterations of the script, you know, Benji was having moments of doubt and, you know... That in the end, that stuff kind of felt like it wasn't really necessary, and we wanted to concentrate on the team dynamic and have the audience infer certain things about where they are, you know, emotionally and stuff. So that felt a little too on the nose, and we moved on from it.
Guys, I'm being wrapped up. I gotta let you go. I was going to ask, are you afraid of death? As one last question, are you afraid of death?
I'm not ready for death yet.
I wasn't offering, but...
Chris also doubles up as a part-time assassin. He'll just whip up a stiletto and stuff
in
there.
I'm not ready for it.
Yeah, I guess so. It's not death I'm afraid of. It's the pain of dying. You know?
It's a spoiler special interview afterwards.
Really? Is that
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
Can I say, I think it's because of my children. I think for me, I look at my daughter and I look at my son and I think my grief is to not see them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
There it lies, not the pain, not the stuff, you know, we can go quickly, whatever.
Yeah.
But it's not seeing them.
When you have kids, you grow another heart. You have another heart beating in the world. That's another life of yours that's beating in the world. That terrifies me. Anyway.
On that
happy podcast. Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. It's all fun. It's been a slam bam, thank you ma'am, kind of interview.
We have to get that right.
Thanks so much indeed.
Thank you, Chris.
Whatever you said, it was amazing. Rebecca, Simon, thanks.
Cheers, buddy. Thank you.
Right, and that was Simon Pegg and Rebecca Ferguson talking about Mission Impossible. Of course, if you want to know more about that film, I can hugely recommend signing up to our spoiler special channels, where we will have the most in-depth interviews I think humanly possible with Chris from Quarry, the writer-director, talking about everything involved in the film. Part one has already been recorded, of course. Part two is they are trying to schedule. God help them. He's also still trying to make part two of Dead Reckoning. So, you know, scheduling could be a problem, but it is something he's determined to make happen. But yeah, it's amazing. It is in-depth. It is exhaustive. And Chris exhausted himself doing it. So it's really, really worth a listen. So yes. Okay. Time now for reviews. Yes. All right.
Why not indeed, Helen?
Shall we start with... Mission:Impossible-Dead Reckoning, Part 1.
The hunt for punctuation.
I choose to accept it.
Yes.
This review will self-destruct.
It obviously came out on Monday, so we did mention it quickly last week. Mm. I don't believe there's much doubt about where we as a podcast individuals stand on this, but does one of you want to tell me what you think?
I think it is amazing. It is so good. This is my second favorite film of the year so far, just behind Spider-Verse. It is that great.
Hard to disagree.
It is more Mission Impossible from Tom Cruise and Christopher McQuarrie. So Ethan Hunt is back on another impossible mission. I won't say too much about the plot this time because they've done a very good job of keeping it hidden in the trailers. And just... leaving it as a surprise for the audiences to find out what that's about. But he is once again having to gather members of the IMF to take on a mysterious entity, shall we say, related to various happenings that are happening around the world, which then means that Ethan Hunt and all of his peeps also have to go around the world to exotic locations to do crazy things in vehicles driving extremely fast, sometimes in places that vehicles shouldn't be. And it is stupendously exciting. I mean, I love basically all the Mission Impossible movies, but this recent run that Macquarie and Cruise have been on with Rogue Nation and Fallout, for me, they absolutely continue that here in terms of just coming up with massively exciting set pieces, things that, you know, either are things you've never seen before, or if they are kind of things you've sort of seen before, are done with such a level of finesse and with a level of attention to detail in every cut, in every camera angle, to show you real people in vehicles doing things that look insanely dangerous, but I'm sure they have ridiculous amounts of insurance to make sure that everyone is fine. You feel the viscerality of the action at the same time for the level of scale here. It's such a funny film. It has like a capery tone. It also brings in Hayley Atwell as Grace, who is like a thief who becomes entangled in the mission that Ethan's on, and the way that Ethan and Grace play off each other, and that she is able to kind of slip out of situations because she's got this kind of sleight of hand thing going on, is so much fun. Rebecca Ferguson is back as Ilsa Faust. Pom Klementieff is added to the cast here from Guardians, Mantis from Guardians. And she plays an assassin called Paris. And in just every single second of Pom's screen time, she is having the time of her goddamn life, getting to play this insane cackling assassin who is on Ethan Hunt's tail. And just watching all of these stars get to play in this massive sandbox and feel the level of play, but also feel the level of precision to pull this stuff off and make it, make you feel it in the audience, make you feel the excitement in the cinema. Mm. I think that's what they do better than basically every other action franchise out there at the moment. It hits you in such a way.
Yeah, it's pure cinema, isn't it? But I think what's interesting is they've been quite, I think, open about the creative process in making these films, about how, yeah, a lot of it is they start with the set pieces and they build a narrative around it. And it makes, you know, I think you could listen to that and you could think going into this, oh, it's just going to be a bunch of stunts tied together with some sort of like flimsy plot. But that isn't the case. And actually the plot in this one I felt was really strong. I thought it has real propulsion to it. It feels very relevant and timely, very compelling. Really love that. I love the character work in this as well. So actually, it's not just incredible stunts, although it really does feature incredible stunts. And I think the beginning of Indy kind of showed us that at this point in time, you've never needed stars to do these stunts less on a purely technical level. But there is something so giddily exciting about seeing Tom Cruise do this, and the way they shoot it in such a way that it's so obviously him doing it, whether it's just landing a parachute or obviously riding a motorbike off a cliff or like hanging off a train. It's all this stuff. It is so exhilarating watching him do it. And all the way through this, like, I was just like, I was exhausted by the end of this film, absolutely exhausted by it. And it was wonderful. It was a wonderful, like, delightfully just joyous cinematic experience, and everyone should go and see it.
Yeah, I'm going to just agree with all that. I agree also with every word of Alex's review. Alex wrote the Empire review and gave it 4 stars. I personally would add an extra star, but I think everything he wrote is 100% correct. And it just has so much energy, this film. Like, there's silent movie, you know, sort of gags and references in there. I think there's Looney Tunes references in there. There are bits 100%. That feel cartoony in the most wonderful way. I just love its energy and its verve and its nerve, for sure. And yeah, it really is a great cinema experience. I had such a good time. I can quibble and have quibbled in our spoiler special, which is also recorded and will be up soon, about aspects of the plot. But really, I was having too much fun to care. Even when I saw something and I'm like, well, that makes no sense, I didn't care. Didn't take me out of it. I was just having a blast. So yeah, I hope you do too. That's Mission Impossible: Dead Reckoning Part 1. Out now in cinemas, good and evil. We say that, right? Okay, another film that is out already, but it did not screen for critics, and I had to go to an actual cinema to see it last week. I know.
You're all right.
I they didn't have my name on a list.
With the public?
I know. I had to buy a ticket. I'm kidding. No, I went to see this basically at 9:45, I think it was, at the Stratford View last week, to see Insidious: The Red Door. Which is, of course, the return of the horror franchise. The last, I think, 2 installments of this have been prequels.
Yeah, 3 and 4 were set not long before 1 and 2, and the connective tissue was Lynn Shay's character, yes. The psychic.
Yes.
But yeah, this is a direct continuation of two.
This is a direct continuation of two. So we're back with the Lambert family. So Patrick Wilson's sort of father, Josh, and his you know, previously also drifting into the further son, Dalton, played by Ty Simpkins, are both back. So we basically meet them at a funeral, and the family has gone wrong since we saw them last. So I think where we left them last time was basically agreeing to get their memories of being able to astral project suppressed. So we get a little replay of that scene just to remind you, these guys have forgotten a thing they can do.
A thing they can do, which was absolutely terrifying and they completely did not want to do because it took them to demony places. And Dalton, the son, was like, that was the twist in the first one. It's like, it's not the house that's haunted. It's your son is haunted because he keeps astrally projecting in his sleep into a place full of spooky demons.
Exactly. So wouldn't you know it, the combination of grief and the upset of kind of, not upset, but the upheaval of going off to college for the first time for Dalton, dropped off by his now somewhat estranged father, leads the seams to come undone and leads these things to start happening again. And of course, neither of them is equipped or prepared for them to happen again because all the memories have been suppressed since last time. So it's basically, once again, the further reaching out to you know, grab them in the nethers and cause problems for them.
I hate when the further does that. I hate when the further grabs me in the nethers.
This is directed by Patrick Wilson, so this is his directorial debut, but it's obviously a situation, a family, a characters that he knows very well, and I think he deals with all of that really, really well. I didn't think all the scares were terribly
scary?
Original. Yeah, I mean, not hugely scary, and you know me, I'm a massive scaredy cat, but also just like they felt a bit done there. It's like, oh, it's a creepy little girl. Oh, it's a dark corridor. Oh, what do you know? The lights keep flickering and going off. Oh, well, that's a bit been there, done that. So, you know, there were elements like that I was like, oh, okay, I see what's happening here. But look, I mean, if you're a completist, if you're a fan of the franchise, you know, it's worth seeing just to see where those characters have gotten to by now. And I think it still has that kind of family, messed up family dynamic in this case, very messed up family dynamic. But it's good for a horror franchise like this to at least go back and try and reckon with some of the stuff that's happened in its past. You know, we've talked in the past on the podcast about how most horror films would end with the person, with the hero of the film being carted off to, at best, a psychiatric hospital, at worst, probably prison after being blamed for all the supernatural events themselves. And at least this one is sort of trying to reckon with, well, what would that leave your family with, you know? But still, having said that, I just thought it was a bit, eh. So I give it 2 stars, this one.
Yeah, I haven't seen this yet. I'm looking forward to seeing it. Does it do anything as bonkers as Insidious Chapter 2, which does a really clever thing of like looping back into the first film and kind of crossing paths with things that we've already seen in a way that's really inventive? I'm hoping for some kind of level of invention here.
There's a level of kind of reference to that, but I would say no.
Mm.
Yeah. And there is a Lynch A, you know, appearance in one form. I'm not going to get into any spoilers or anything. But so everyone is kind of present and correct. Everyone's back. Rose Byrne is in there as well. I just didn't think it was particularly exciting. So yeah, 2 stars then for Insidious The Red Door. Now, there is another scary film out this week, and that is Bird Box Barcelona, which hits Netflix today. James, you loved the first film more than you love either of us.
That's very true.
I saw the first film with you, and I remember finding it like, fine. Yeah. I had an okay time. We left the screening together, and I was like, yeah, that was all right. And you were like, that was outstanding. You were like in a reverie about Bird Box, and I was happy for you. I often am in that situation. Yeah, it's true. On the other side.
Normally, I was about to say, we're normally in reverse over these things, but to make sure, so I really, really was obsessed with Bird Box when it came out. Suzanne Bier's film just really, something about it just captivated me, but I always thought that it kind of lost out by coming out the same year as A Quiet Place. I felt that it didn't get the respect it deserved. So I rewatched it to check if I was being a bit of a lunatic about it. And it stands up. It's still a masterpiece. I still love it. So I went into Bird Box Barcelona with a slightly sort of, I guess, weird mindset, because this isn't really what I wanted. So Josh Malerman, who wrote Bird Box, also wrote a sequel to Bird Box called Mallory, which continues the adventures, if you will, of Sandra Bullock's character after she gets to where she gets to at the end of the first film. Instead of, I don't know, adapting that, Netflix decided to go a slightly different route. And there could be another reason for this. Maybe they can't get Sandra Bullock again. Entirely possible.
And it's also not necessarily never going to happen. It just hasn't happened with this particular film.
Sure. Except what they've actually done instead was, instead of going to their creative department, feels a lot like they've gone to their marketing department and said, guys, 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 I've got a global marketing strategy, guys, and it's this, and we're going to do a regional franchise spin-off starting in Barcelona.
Bird Box Barcelona.
Yes, Bird Box Barcelona. To be followed by Bird Box Magaluf and Bird Box Santorini down the road.
How dare you
and
both?
Look, it's... So essentially what you've got is the same fucking film, but in Spanish. So...
But you love the film.
I know! But the thing is, it's all the stuff that works so well about the first film. So it's the shock factor. What works about the... Like, you get Sarah Paulson in at the very beginning and then just kill her horribly. And it's so viscerally upsetting. Because obviously it's like The Happening, right? It's all about people killing themselves. They see the aliens, they kill themselves. Or see whatever these things are, kill themselves. And it's so shocking. And it's so, you know, there's something about... Like, you get to know these characters and they're getting picked off by themselves, essentially one by one during that film. And in this, you don't get any of that. Like, so this... And I'm going to tread on the plot carefully, mainly because film has one ace up its sleeve and it's important that you don't really see that coming. So this focuses on Mario Casas, who plays a character called Sebastian. Him and his daughter are kind of trying to make their way to safety across the ruins of Barcelona. It takes place, broadly speaking, in the same time frame as the first film. The first film obviously had a situation... Well, because it's they both have dual timelines. So the first film takes place... The first film takes place, it's immediately after the outbreak, and then it flashes forward to when she's on the river. You know, she's going to where she's going. This one takes place a little bit later, but then flashes back to immediately after the outbreak. So it covers, broadly speaking, the same two rough timeframes. But the thing with this is, a lot of the same beats seem to be, it's very similar, but just not as effective. And my issue with a lot of these things are, when you have a mythology that you try and demystify, it just doesn't work for me. I like the mystery is what makes Bird Box so good. You don't know what these things are. It doesn't explain it. In here, it tries to broaden mythology, and I just thought made it feel very prosaic and very tedious as it went.
Helen looks flabbergasted by every word you're saying.
I am so confused by literally everything you're saying. It's like, did we watch the same film?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's not a mythology. It's individuals' explanations for what's happening, but it doesn't actually...
Yes and no. But the thing is, it's very difficult to have this conversation. I know what you're saying. The nature of them, yes. But the reality of what's going on around it is explored in greater detail, greater scientific detail. And I felt that took away from the overall mythology of the film. We're not going to do a spoiler special on this, but were we going to? Yeah. This would be the discussion.
Okay. Is there a big board on the wall that says, it's sound?
No,
it's not that. It's eyes.
There are some eyes graffitied around
that
Barcelona.
That is true.
So I guess anyway.
You just love the architecture. You're like, it's Barcelona. Or were you not upset by the geography?
I did have one issue with one place that they're trying to get to by one route, when there is another route that would seem to me to be easier. Okay, that's all I'm saying. I also, like, it's not quite the same timeline, because she is a 5-year-old in Bird Box when she's on the river.
Okay,
and it's
sure.
been 9 months total in
broadly
this film.
Speaking. So, but what I'm saying is, you have the immediate aftermath of the thing, and then you have a little bit further on.
But I thought this was. I just think that the things we're absolutely not going to talk about, and the way that things are developed in this film, and the way that people approach the monsters in this film, was really different and really fascinating. And I very much enjoyed that. I thought this was head and shoulders above the first film.
Oh my God, you're wrong. This is absolute.
I really thought it was head and shoulders above the first film. I had so much of a better time with it. The things we're not going to talk about, I thought were great.
I mean, they're fine.
I will go with you as far as like the last 2 minutes of the film, where I was a bit like, oh, I don't think we need to do that. But up until that point, I'm like super into it. Really good, by the way. We should mention, first of all, the directors. This is the Pastor brothers.
Yeah.
David and Alex. And it is also stars the likes of Georgina Campbell.
Yeah.
We've got Diego Calva from fucking Babylon. Look, yes. Nothing against him.
Babylon Hive. Come join me.
Yeah, so I can just.
We're partying and we're covered in elephant shit.
Oh, boy. Anyway, so it is a good cast, but I thought he was absolutely fantastic in the lead role.
He's good. And I think what they do with this, that they give you, let's say, an interesting perspective on the environment, which is the one new idea that it has, the only new idea that it has. And I just felt like it, and that was great. And I really liked that one aspect. But again, I didn't think you became invested in really any of the characters with the sole exception of Sebastian. And I just, again, all the way through, I was like, I've seen all this. I've seen it done better. I've seen it done with more emotional heft. I've seen it done more stylishly and I've seen it better directed. And it just felt, I just felt like this film doesn't need to exist. I do not need the first installment in a redundant regional franchise. What I needed was the Mallory sequel.
I haven't seen this yet. And after this discussion, I'm going to, because I need to have a position on this. My thoughts for now, as somebody who hasn't seen this film, is that Bird Box Barcelona is a terrible title. And I'm intrigued by the Bird Box element, because the Bird Box is something that Mallory comes up with in the first film because she realizes that birds don't sing when the monsters are near.
Well,
so she has a box.
They go berserk when the monsters are near.
That's it. It's the opposite. They go crazy. So she has a box with some birds in it.
Yeah.
So that if the birds in the box start to go...
I mean, no spoilers, but this is a city, so there are pigeons. So.
But are they in a box?
I mean... maybe in a way, the box grid of the streets of Barcelona.
Yes. Maybe they're
the
all
box.
In a box, Ben.
Aren't
maybe
we
the
all
bird box
in a box?
Was the friends we made along the way in Barcelona.
In Barcelona.
And maybe it'll be like Bird Box Bonn next, Bird Box Bombay.
Oh, no, it's going to be like Bird Box Blackpool. That's next.
I'd watch all of these.
We're just going to see the outbreak in a bunch of sort of tourist destinations.
And you're saying regional like it's a bad thing. I think it's a good thing to not have every international, you know, worldwide disaster happen in the US.
With you 100%. And one of the things I really love about Amazon Prime is the power, which obviously is cheating because it's based on Naomi Alderman's book, but the fact that it shows you this huge society changing event from all these different international perspectives, I think that really, really works.
It's one of the great things about World War Z.
Yeah, 100%. Well. Yeah, and I think that's great. Having a global perspective on things is brilliant, but it just felt like a really...
You just love Mallory and you just wanted more of her story.
Yes, I want more of Mallory's story. Give it to me now.
All right. Well, James, unfortunately for me, wrote the Empire Review.
Yes.
And you gave this?
And gave this a well-deserved 2 stars.
You are an absolute monster.
2 stars. And if we're going to talk monsters, it's whoever gave the original Bird Box 3 stars when it's clearly a 4.
It's a 3. This one's a 4.
Absolutely not.
I'm just going to, I'm not going to spend a huge amount of time on this, but also on Netflix last week, The Outlaws dropped, and people may have seen the trailer for that one. This is the one, we all know where we're going with this, but let's not get ahead of ourselves.
So it's like The In-Laws, but they're outlaws.
Yeah, what if your in-laws were outlaws? So what if you... Owen Browning, played by Adam Devine from, you know, Pitch Perfect, was getting married and really punching above your weight, if I'm honest. Like, no disrespect to him, but Nina Dobrev from The Vampire Diaries is playing his affianced. And all is well. They are getting together. They're setting up the wedding with his mad parents, played by Richard Kind, and the great Julie Haggerty from Airplane. Until at the very last minute, much to everyone's surprise, it turns out her parents can visit. He's always been told that they are researchers in the Amazon jungle living with a remote tribe. It turns out that might not be 100% true. And in fact, they may be bank robbers, with one of them doing a very ill-advised Scottish accent.
Wow.
Yeah. Look, it's fun. I watched it on a Friday night when I had no brain capacity to do anything. And it was fine. I'm not saying it's good or original or anything you haven't seen a million times before, though. So yeah, this got 2 stars from us. And
yes.
I think that's about right, if I'm honest. Like, it's not, you know, again, if it's Friday night and your brain is just like, no more anything, this'll do.
And you want to watch something that's just a bit shit, then either watch this or Bird Box Barcelona.
Bird Box Barcelona is good. I refuse to give in on this point. You're a monster. Anyway, just to finish up, there is one more film I wanted to mention, and it's a documentary out this week. It's called Squaring the Circle: The Story of Hypnosis. Now, I didn't just say hypnosis wrong, like hip as in cool, and then gnosis as in knowledge or wise. And this is, I believe, the first feature-length documentary from Anton Corbijn, who, of course, made the likes of Control, a really great photographer turned director. And he obviously got his start working with musicians, right? He was one of the great, you know, band photographers. And not in the sense he was banned, like he took pictures of band.
Right.
Just to be clear. So this tells the story of a pair of artists called Storm and Poe, who basically got together as teenagers, started working together as teenagers, and became the album art designers of the 1970s. In particular, it was 60s into the 70s. So most recognizably, Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon is one of their creations. But they worked with Peter Gabriel. They worked with Paul McCartney. They worked a lot with Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin, 10cc. All of these people, absolutely iconic images that they created. And because Corbyn is very switched on and clued into that world, he's able to get all of those people, essentially, all the surviving people anyway, in to talk about this work. And also, you know, the likes of just fans of that kind of album art, like Noel Gallagher, who's just in being hilarious and being funny. And it's look, if you're not interested in music, it's probably not got a huge amount to offer you. But I was kind of fascinated by it. And I don't listen to most of these albums. So, but I was still intrigued to hear just more about how they were created. I mean, at points, they basically rocked up in the middle of the Sahara Desert with a bunch of deflated footballs, one hand pump, and had to create a sort of iconic image out of that. They tried to get a sheep to lie on a psychiatrist's couch in the surf in Hawaii for one album cover. They were just doing crazy, crazy stuff. And they were based, you know, around the corner from us in Denmark Street. So it's just quite interesting stuff. Anyway, so we don't, I believe, have an Empire review yet. I think that's at least a 3, possibly a 4 if you're a muso. But it's out this week. All right. I think that is it for this week's Empire podcast. Next week, we are only going to be joined by Christopher Bloody Nolan to talk Oppenheimer.
He's the bomb, yo.
He is the bomb. And he's not even the only director joining us. Laura McGann, who is the director of a fabulous new documentary called The Deepest Breath, is also due to be on the podcast. So much to play for. So please do rejoin us then. Thank you for listening this time. And that is all. It is goodbye from Ben. Ben, where can people find you, by the way, if they want more of your Disneyfication?
People can find me personally at Ben S. Travis. I'm not on Threads yet. I'm holding off on
Threads.
You're
not Threads. On Threads? Oh, you're so uncool.
I'm going to wait until people are actually using Threads. I'm holding on to the Titanic.
Helen and I are on Threads.
Maybe I'll join you on Threads, but I'm at Ben S. Travis. And yeah, you just read all my empireonline.com. Read my glorious words.
Right. And it's goodbye to James Dyer.
Goodbye. Tiffany Haddish is joining us on the next Pilot TV podcast.
You've had
After
your
Party
mentions.
Season 2, which is very exciting. Please book tickets to the live show on the 19th of August. And you can find me at James C. Dyer on Twitter, Instagram, and the Threads.
Well, it's goodbye from me. I'm Helen L. O'Hara on Twitter. I'm on Threads, although I don't like it.
Nobody likes it, Helen. We use it because we must.
And I'm also on Blue Sky, which I do like.
I'm not on Blue Sky. It's just you and Christopher McQuarrie, isn't it?
Yeah, and we're having a great time. So, yeah, I'm on all of them. God help me. I hate them all. That's not true. I don't hate some of them, but I do hate the billionaires who own them. Anywho, it's goodbye from me. Please do join us again next week. And in the meantime, we're off to try and get James Taylor Swift tickets.
So all you need is a code. And then with the code, you need the website. You have to be logged into the website already, onto the Ticketmaster, sign in to Ticketmaster already, get in the waiting room half an hour before. Then you are going to be assigned a place in the queue. And then once you're in the room, once you've gone through the queue, you add your code. And if you have two parts of the code and you put them together, it diffuses
the bomb.
The bomb.
This is just the plot of Dead Reckoning Part 2, isn't it? That's where we're at.
It is.
Yeah.
Ethan Hunt's mission is to try and get Taylor Swift tickets.
So basically, jump off a mountain on a motorbike and you should be fine.
I'll do it.
Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.